Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Friday, April 30th, 2021. The time is 1:32. We're meeting in the State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance today are Senator Schauer, Senator Keel, Senator Myers, Senator Hughes, and myself. Senator Holland is chair. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Nate, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. My apologies to the public for having to cancel the meeting on Wednesday, and I appreciate your patience. We will pick up the business from Wednesday's agenda today. First up is Senate Joint Resolution 5, a proposed amendment to the constitutional spending limit by the governor. Caroline Schultz and Neil Steininger will introduce the bill on behalf of the administration. So if y'all would please take the table. And I see we have a presentation in front of us right now. And if y'all would please, as you speak, state your name, place yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget.
Good afternoon. My name is Caroline Schultz, also from the Office of Management and Budget.
And thank you today for hearing Senate Joint Resolution 5, the governor's amendment to the constitutional spending limit. So to start, I'd like to talk a little bit about why we're proposing an amendment to the constitutional spending limit. This chart here shows historical saving balances as well as revenues and expenditures over the last roughly decade. You can see that we had a peak of a little over $16 billion in savings in our constitutional budget reserve and statutory budget reserve in fiscal year 13. At that time, we also had increasing expenditures, the red lines that you see there. Those expenditures were allowed to increase over the high revenue years that preceded the buildup of these savings balances because the state has a constitutional spending limit that is ineffective in controlling growth of state spending. So as we had revenues increase going to its peak in fiscal year 2012, we had expenditures that kept pace with revenue. And then we're unsustainable when our revenues declined. And that'll be a little bit even better illustrated on this next graph here. So this graph here shows in the dark line, solid dark line at the top, the current constitutional spending limit. So you can see that it was set around where expenditures were in fiscal year 82, but has grown outpacing expenditures and kind of outpacing any reasonable constraint or limitation on spending over time. You can see on this graph that there are really only 2 years where the state even had enough revenue to actually spend as high as the spending limit was calculated. So this spending limit that we currently are operating under is completely ineffective at actually putting constraint on state budgets. So a little more about this graph. The green lines here show you UGF revenue in any given fiscal year. The orange line shows you expenditures. The dotted lower line shows you a kind of what if SGR, our constitutional amendment, had been implemented in 1982 at the same time as our current spending limit. So you can see that under that regime, you would have a spending limit that much more closely matched and constrained spending with some flexibility for change, but it would have prevented that run-up in expenditures we saw when revenues peaked in the early aughts. And a little bit about the history of our current spending limit. You know, it was enacted and started in fiscal year 82 and voted on by the people and had a window for reconsideration and then was reaffirmed by the voters in that reconsideration. So it was, you know, the concept of a spending limit is fairly popular. However, the spending limit we're currently operating under just doesn't provide any constraint.
Question or comment from Senator Schauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple things I want to point out, because we've gone through this. This is not our first rodeo. We went all through this again 2 years ago, and you're aware of that. But I want to, we're doing this with several of these constitutional amendments just to kind of put this back in the record so the public's aware as we discuss it. But a couple of things. First of all, just a couple of questions, Mr. Chairman, in order. It won't take long if that's okay.
Sure.
First one is, could you just comment, and I won't prep the battlefield, with what the fund balance would roughly be today, because we talk about sustainability of the fund and then how much it would provide for government and growth, et cetera, had this been enacted. What would the current fund balance be today? I think that's an important number people should hear, had we not been able to spend how we wanted to. Whoever would like to answer.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Caroline Schultz, Office Management and Budget. That area under the curve between the orange line and the dotted line is about $35 million. If that were added to the permanent fund balance, we would be upwards of $100 billion in the total permanent fund balance in that kind of hypothetical scenario. If we had that much in the permanent fund today, our POMB draw, 5% of that value would be sufficient to cover our unrestricted general fund expenditures for government.
And I think Senator Hall was going to correct, it's $35 billion, not
right.
Million. You said million, it's okay.
The first time you said $35 million, but also sometimes I have a little hard time hearing. I'm assuming you meant billion.
You did.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think you spoke correctly, $105 billion
yes,
today.
Yes, $35 billion.
Okay. And a follow-up, if I may, Mr.
Follow-up.
So in addition to that, and Mr. King had done some charts as well when we were here before, and he showed that depending on how you played the game and interest and other things and what was put back into the fund, he had estimated it could be as high as $120 to $125 billion in the fund. So it could have been even higher. Okay, so enough. And the second part of this is that I think it's important to put back in the record is we did a lot of modifications to the previous version of this 2 years ago, which all it didn't go anywhere. It got stopped in finance again. I want to make sure it's clear because people see the spend in the graph, and then we talk about how much we've reduced spending, and there's been some what I would personally call a little bit of misinformation about how much we have reduced spending. One of those bumps talks about the big extra PERS payment, so I'd like you to just discuss that if you could. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have. It was a wise move, in my opinion, to get it, you know, in the get it where it needs to be. However, that has also been used to show how much we cut spending in a lot of ways when that was a extra payment that we didn't have to make. That was probably smart. And then a lot of the reduction was to capital budget. So I think it's important in this chart they see that because I think a lot of folks don't understand how this chart grew and why it came back down when we discuss how where we are for spending. And I'm not contending we didn't reduce government. We did. But I want it to be a fair discussion of, you know, people go, look, we spent all that money and we made this many reductions to spending. That's not actually true when you look at it. And I just like to kind of get it on the record so we're discussing it apples to apples.
Did you understand the question buried in there?
Yes, I did.
Carolyn does because she's gone through it. So I'm not sure who, Mr. Chairman, but I know it's spinning backwards, but I think it's important for context. There's a lot to this, and she was around for a lot of it. So thank you.
And through the chair, Senator Schauer. So one thing to note on that issue of the PERS payment, it isn't reflected on this graph because it actually is an expenditure not subject to the cap. Because it's a deposit into another state savings account, you know, we don't consider that subject to the cap. However, on this graph, it is included because this graph is really showing how we've drawn down those rainy day balance accounts and that spend down of the $16 billion in reserves over the last 10 years, just to kind of illustrate the position that we're in today, because that was a transfer out of the CBR, so it did draw down that fund. But on this graph, we're not showing that PERS payment just because it's not subject to the cap. And in your statement, a lot of these reductions you see in the, you know, the drop in the reddish orange line on here really are reductions to the capital budget. That was most of the gross going into the high years was a growing capital budget. And so reductions in the capital budget really are the, you know, primary first place that the state began cutting when we had revenue drop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought that was important for the discussion because some people say you see the context of it. It's important that we understand that. Mm-hmm. So again, we're apples to apples. So I appreciate you letting us get them on the record.
Senator Hughes?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Schauer hit on a point that I was going to make, so I'm going to make a different one. I'm looking back in 82 when the what's currently in the Constitution was instituted. Kind of surprised to see the red line, the UGF spend, as high as it was. Are these nominal dollars or inflation-adjusted dollars?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I believe these are nominal dollars, yes.
Okay, and follow up. And this may be a Bill Milks question because it's more about the historical context of passing a constitutional amendment, getting it through the legislature, and getting it before the voters. But being that the limit was bringing down what had been spent. I'm just wondering how well that went over, Mr. Barnhill. I'm not sure who the best one it is, but I guess I had the incorrect assumption that they were setting it maybe a little bit higher than that, than how it was just what they had just spent, and that there would be more voter approval. But when you're setting your cap lower than your most recent budget, I'm just surprised to see that. Do you have any comments historically about how that happened?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that is a really good question, because that is, you know, as you look at the graph, and maybe Caroline, who prepared the graph, might be able to speak a little bit to this.
Through the chair, to Senator Hughes, the history of the constitutional appropriation limit, obviously voters, it was enacted by the legislature and voters approved on it before it went into effect. So if I'm thinking about the timing correctly, they would have approved it during the fiscal year 1980 budget cycle, approved it, you know, effective for the 1982 budget cycle, except that's not how it went. It was approved in 1982. So I guess to say I do not believe at the time that it was implemented that voters were intentionally implementing a spending cap lower than expected appropriations.
Okay, and just follow up. I find it fascinating, because what we're proposing today is not to start at a point below where we are. So I just fascinating that the voters approved it, because it looks like it was about a half billion or so above, which is pretty considerable difference. And had they grown the budget that much since they went on the ballot? I don't know. You could get back with us, but I just find it fascinating that the people of Alaska would wish to do that. I actually think it's great that they thought to do that, but it just, the formula was wrong, because, and my understanding is because it had the population adjuster and the inflation adjuster, and it was just too much, and so it allowed it to ramp up. But thank you.
And I'll just, you can check those answers and get back with us later. I just wanted to tell the committee that Senator Keel extended his apologies. He had a prior commitment. He might make it back before the meeting's over. Did you have a further comment? Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hughes, I would not read that assumption into this graph, if I may. I believe that probably there's some imprecision in the historical look back at UGF spending and differences in counting and accounting for the kind of historical budget look back versus the notion that voters intentionally started with a cap that was lower. I will definitely get back with kind of a more accurate accounting of finances at that point, but I think it's far more likely that there's imprecision in this chart rather than an actual intentional desire to start with an appropriation limit that was lower than spending at the time.
Thank you.
All right, with no further questions, please continue your presentation.
So a little bit about SJR 5 and how it's structured. So we are looking, as we said, to fix the calculation to limit spending. So in order to do that, we're changing the way that the spending limit is calculated, both how it is based and then how it is, how it has adjusters applied to it over time to increase. So we've set it up to be that it may not exceed the prior three-year average by more than the greater of inflation or population. So while the current spending cap sets a dollar value base and extends by a compounding of both inflation and population, we're looking to set an average base of the prior years so that that base is based more closely on actual spending and the real situation, current situation of the state, and not the situation the state was in the 80s, and then accelerate it only by the greater of inflation or population. So that still allows for adjustment in spending based on natural pressure on the cost of government, but doesn't create this, you know, compounding effect over time of, you know, adjusting it based on sort of greater than the natural cost pressure to government. We've also looked to clarify the definition of what types of appropriations are subject to the cap. So we're including appropriations of any state funds, so unrestricted general fund and designated general fund. But we're excluding some certain appropriations. We're excluding the permanent fund dividend payments. We're excluding the expenditure of bond proceeds, so general obligation bonds have been voted on by the people, as well as the cost to pay down that debt service. We're excluding deposits into state savings accounts, things like the $3 billion deposit made to the PERS system. We're excluding disaster response to ensure that there's the ability to respond in the event of a disaster. And we're excluding non-state funds that are received for a specific purpose. So that would be things like federal receipts for federal programs, or other funds received for a specific purpose or held in trust by the state.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So since we're excluding federal funds, one thing that does concern me about this proposal is it seems like it would give the legislature the incentive to effectively make our budget more dependent on the federal government, because people will tend to try to spend more based out of those federal funds whenever possible, and then hence leave us even more dependent on whatever the feds get us. If I understand correctly, right now approximately half our budget comes from federal expenditures. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, roughly speaking, 40 to 45%, a significant portion of our budget comes from federal receipts. Yes.
Senator Hughes?
And just as to dovetail with that, I'm thinking back when Medicaid expansion was out there, and I can't remember 90%, 100% of that was federally funded, then that backed off, and it increased, that state's obligation was then increased. So in that case, that would be problematic if you wouldn't have those federal funds. So has there been any consideration? This is more of a finance table discussion, but in something that's being proposed like that where it's going to be backed off, that maybe we need to make sure that it is counted, or I don't know. I just see that as a problem.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that actually is a question we've been asking ourselves since this was put forward, especially given the federal revenue climate we're in right now. There's a lot of federal revenues coming in that can be used to offset general fund expenditures, and how that would get cared for in a spending limit that's based on the average of 3 years of general fund expenditures. If we spend the next several years receiving federal money that can offset general fund expenditures, how do we manage that under a spending limit once those federal revenues go away? The example of Medicaid expansion is a great example, because that is a little bit outside the current sort of pandemic crisis situation we're in right now, maybe a little more normal, where federal government provides revenue to start a program and then backs off their participation, and how do we adjust for that? And that is a question that needs to be sought through, especially if we're looking to have a spending limit that more effectively constrains gross and general fund expenditures.
With no more questions, Senator Schauer.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, you almost got by. You talk faster. Capital budget, I don't see it in there. It's something we discussed. Maybe it's coming up. If it is, that's fine. Where is that going to fall? Because that was a big part of our discussion, to include waterfall provision that we had done 2 years ago, so that if we had excess years, there was some ability to spend outside of that, so we could catch up on some of the capital things we needed to do. Mostly we were talking, repair infrastructure, et cetera. So is that captured somewhere in this? If not, it's something we need to discuss. Second question is account for deflation. That was one of the things that came up before. When we have deflationary periods, how does that work? And it may be captured in your formula, but we discussed it because it actually was putting downward pressure on the formula. It actually went into slightly negative numbers a couple of years ago based on how we originally set it up. So somebody could potentially address that as well, please.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Schauer. In terms of capital, we've removed the kind of discussion of a set aside for capital from this version of the spending limit compared to the current constitutional spending limit. So all capital spending, UGF and DGF, fits under the cap and has to be contained within that allocation of resources. Similarly, there's no, you know, relief valve built in, you know, kind of as you're alluding to, in a peak revenue year, could you have a relief valve? There's none of that kind of mechanism built into it currently. So how you would handle or accommodate that sort of situation would have to be a policy discussion in considering an appropriation limit. And then, sorry, what was your last piece? Deflationary, yes. So the way that this is set up is it's a greater of inflation or population. So if we had a deflationary period but population was stagnant, so say CPI went down negative 1% but population was zero, then it would just, this would adjust by that 0%. So it's the greater of the two. But if we have both population and inflation down, so we had large out-migration and, you know, deflationary effect on CPI, you would see this, you know, ratchet down by whichever is greater. So it could happen, certainly.
Chairman, just a comment?
I'll just let the committee know we do plan to cover a public testimony on this one and SJR 7 and possibly public testimony on that one. So it's just the first time we've heard it. But Senator Schauer.
Just a comment, and I apologize, but there's so much information from the previous 2 years. I want it on the record. It will help. It's something, Mr. Chairman, I think we'll need to discuss because it kind of sort of helped kill it initially in the building when it didn't have that, because you try to squash our very minimum capital budget under what we do right now. There was no room for growth knowing we need to catch up. So there's ways to do supplementals and other things, but it's something I think it will bear discussing in this committee on how we might do that on good revenue years, because it allows, I think, pragmatically to help us get it potentially through the building where we could do some of the play catch up. So for what it's worth, thank you.
Senator Hughes?
Yes, thank you. And first, I want to get on the record that I love Alaskans and I don't like to see our population go down. But now I'm going to ask a question about the population growth, because, and I'm not a fan of taxes, too, get that on the record. When you have a broad-based tax and population goes up, your revenues go up with the growing population. When you don't have a broad-based tax and more people move here, what you have is you have greater need for state spending, because you have you need more public safety, you need more schools, you're paying more out more PFDs. So why are we even considering population growth? Because and also with economies of scale, just because you have another 10,000 people doesn't necessarily mean you need more state employees in a division, for example. So I'm just confused why we're even using population growth.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, you're on to a very good point here, is that it doesn't scale perfectly. When you have population increase, your cost of government services, not every cost of government services scales perfectly with that population growth. However, for effectively simplicity of calculation, using population growth or inflation, it makes it a little bit easier to calculate the spending limit and calculate that escalator. Having to do effectively an economic study every time the population changed to see what portion of that population drove government services, say, you know, through social services programs or what have you, wouldn't be an effective way to kind of easily calculate the expenditure limit. The greater of population or inflation allows for some ability to grow, but not unconstrained growth. And they are, we've looked at several different escalators that you can apply, and these tend to be, ones that have decent data that we can get to and are fairly stable and reliable. But they're not perfect indicators of demand on or cost of government services. CPI isn't necessarily going to perfectly align to, say, cost changes in the Medicaid program that can diverge greatly from CPI. So there's no perfect measure, there's no perfect escalator, but these tend to be ones with available data and stability.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's safe to say that this is an odd year budget-wise already. And I'm looking at the non-state funds for a specific purpose. So we talk primarily about federal funds in that regard. Usually when the feds give us money, it's for a specific reason, education, Medicaid, et cetera. But this is a strange year in that they're giving us $1 billion without explicitly, at least they haven't yet, explicitly stated what it's for. And I'm curious how that would interact with this proposal.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that would still fall under non-state funds for a specific purpose. And I think specific purpose, as probably understood by a layperson, probably wouldn't include the $1 billion. I can understand that. The $1 billion of ARP money that we're currently discussing, you know, in the appropriation process. But there are, you know, specific criteria within it, even though they are very broad. So it would fall under kind of that definition of specific purpose. We are restricted in our use of those monies, even though it's limited restriction. They're not, you know, unrestricted, available for general appropriation dollars. It is a weird budget year, though. Normally, we have a very small amount of federal revenues that have, are fairly unrestricted. So this is an odd year, certainly.
All right. With no further questions, slide five. Are you finished with slide four?
Mm-hmm.
Slide number five.
So slide five discusses the amendments to the CBR provision in the Constitution, Article 9, Section 17. So this provision in the Constitution lays out the constitutional budget reserve as well as how it's accessed. SJR 5 amends the access provisions and allows for appropriations from the constitutional budget reserve by a simple majority vote in situations where there's inadequate general fund revenues to meet expenditures. It also removes the general fund liability to the CBR and what's known as a CBR sweep, where we repay CBR debt by sweeping the subfunds of the general fund. And so this enables the CBR to continue to be used as a rainy day account, but does remove that three-quarter vote provision on its use.
With no questions, slide six.
So slide six starts to get into some of the modeling that we've done, and I'm going to hand it over to Caroline Schultz to discuss some of the modeling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Caroline Schultz. What I would like to highlight here is some kind of hypothetical situations had we implemented the constitutional spending limit as proposed by SJR 5 in different years in our recent budget history. So there's a lot of lines on this graph, so I'll walk through them. You can see in the background, in the upper area of the background, the dotted gray line shows the current constitutional spending limit, the Article 9, Section 16 limit, is up at the top, obviously ineffective as we discussed. You can also see the lower dotted gray line. That's if we reset that constitutional spending limit to current budget year and just let it grow with the compounded population and inflation metric. You can also see in the background there is a green line reflecting revenue and an orange line reflecting expenditures. I'd like to draw the committee's attention to the blue lines, which reflect the alternate hypothetical scenarios had we implemented SJR 5 in different years. And what I want to do is highlight the fact that the three-year moving average concept, when you reset your base, allows your spending limit to ratchet down to reflect fiscal realities. So if you started in fiscal year 2000 or fiscal year 2005, you have a fairly restrained appropriation limit because at that point in time, spending was more constrained by revenue and the fiscal situation at the time. However, if you look at the fiscal year 2010, or particularly the fiscal year 2015 appropriation limits under the SJR 5 calculation, you can see that they start high, but they're able to adjust downward based on real spending because of the three-year moving average reset of the base each year. So you have a couple years where your spending limit is a little bit higher than real appropriation, but it does adjust and it does allow your spending limit to move along with the fact that you might have changes in your revenue situation or your spending situation.
No question, Mr. Chairman.
And I don't want the Judiciary Committee to feel stifled because my committee staff has reminded me we have 5 and 7 on Monday as well. So questions away, Senator Schauer.
No I'm afraid, Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid to ask now. No, I'm just kidding. I'm good. So could you just, Carolyn, talk a little bit again on, there was also discussion we had that centered around, should we be looking at revenues when we talk about cap, the spending cap, as opposed to just, you know, spending, et cetera. So as you work your way backwards in the five-year rolling average, could you also discuss how we had that debate, or at least a little bit of it, again, for context, on using the difference in how you just explained it might also adjust, can kind of account for it? Because I think that's important, because there was quite a few, there was a couple proposals to look at it from a, and I know your staff was involved in this, on the debate of whether we do it this way or we use, you know, past, you know, basically revenue, et cetera. So if you could, briefly.
Sure. Through the chair, to Senator Schauer's question, yes, mathematically, you certainly could incorporate historical revenue into your spending cap as well, which would, again, allow for some flexibility to change depending on your revenue situation. You could have a, I mean, essentially the sky's the limit, and the imagination's the limit when it comes to different ways to calculate a spending cap. And I think fundamentally, the question is, at a very high level, what is the goal of the policymakers that are deciding on these questions? You know, how much flexibility is important to you versus restraint when it comes to establishing the parameters around your cap calculation?
And is that why, Mr. Chairman, that they chose this model as the administration? Just explain that over anything else, that this method was chosen because so it's out there?
Yeah, through the chair, to Senator Schauer, yes, this method was chosen because it allows for some flexibility, but fundamentally it is a restrained spending limit, which did match our goal and our administration's goal of keeping a lid on runaway spending.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, I believe we'd be on slide 7.
Thank you. Again, Caroline Schultz. This is a bit of a forecast of looking at different scenarios if we implemented SJR 5 today. And so the time period on this graph, instead of looking back in time, is looking forward in time. And I'd like to point out that it is challenging to model forward-looking appropriation limits that are based on a three-year moving average, because not only do you have to forecast economic conditions, you also have to forecast future spending, which, you know, that's difficult. It's hard to know what our spending is going to be next year. So looking at this graph here, we have in the background, the blue line shows the, you know, kind of official Department of Revenue revenue forecast. And the orange line reflects spending as presented in the OMB 10-year plan. And of course, that's based on some assumptions looking forward on spending.
Question from
our graph does not match what they have there, I'm just realizing. So I don't know if you, maybe we should just be looking at what you have. Because ours,
I thought I was having a flash of color blindness.
Ours has a green line between the two dotted lines.
We'll pay attention to your lines.
We'll watch yours.
Do you have a another graph after that one? Maybe we're just missing one in our brief at ease. Senate Judiciary Committee, back on the record. Welcome back, Senator Keel.
Thank you.
And we just mentioned that the graph on in front of us doesn't exactly match what we have in our presentation, so we're going to pay attention to that one for right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so back at the graph on the screen, and we will make sure the committee members all have the appropriate graph in their packets as well. You can see that there are two dotted lines, and those reflect different spending caps proposed by SJR 5. The top one reflects kind of the maximum level of spending given inflation assumptions of 2.25% growth in CPI and 0.5% population growth. And if that would be the spending cap if you maximized your spending each year. And of course, you know, something we always say is that a spending limit is a cap, it's not necessarily a goal. So what you can see in the lower dotted line is if spending matched what was proposed in the OMB 10-year plan. And it's a much lower cap because your spending's lower. So that makes sense that, again, because of that three-year average concept, your spending cap will adjust to your level of spending.
Are there any questions? Senator Hughes.
Yeah, this is a legal question for Bill Milks. If he is he available for this discussion? So, Bill, we all know the Willikowski versus the state having to do with PFD and the appropriation power given to the legislature overrides anything in statute. Now we have two appropriation, if this were to be adopted and our Constitution amended, now we would have two different appropriation things in our Constitution. Is there any conflict, or is, if this limit were in the Constitution, the legislature would only be limited as far as appropriations in regard to total spend, but as far as some other law, a formula or whatever, the legislature would be free to because of their appropriation power, to maybe appropriate differently than a formula in statute. In other words, would there be any conflict with this and our appropriation power in the Constitution?
Through the chair.
Yes, please proceed, place your name, put yourself on the record.
Bill Milks from the Department of Law. Through the chair, Senator Hughes. I think two answers to your question. First, yes, the Constitution provides that the legislature has the appropriation power. This is an amendment to the Constitution, similar to the one that already exists, which is placing a limit on the appropriation power. So those two constitutional provisions will have to work together. So the legislature will have the power of appropriation. There will also be a limit through this constitutional amendment on total sum of appropriations. But it would not change the law as interpreted by the Alaska Supreme Court in the Willikowski case regarding examples of programs set out in statute that would represent that money would be spent on some purpose. Like in the Willikowski case, permanent fund dividends, there have been a couple other cases. The court's decision on that, which was interpreting the Constitution, said that still the legislature must appropriate, so the statute can't override it. So the constitutional appropriation requirement, regardless of what a particular statute might say, would continue. The general constitutional power the legislature to appropriate would be interpreted, I believe, in the same way it is right now, which is there is an overall appropriation limit. I hope that's not too wordy, but that would be my response.
Thank you.
It was wordy enough to generate a question from Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, it did generate one quick question. I hope it's quick. Bill, when we, as I understand it, I'm not a lawyer, so that's why I'm asking for clarification, that we can have a case like this adjudicated by the court, they make a decision, they give their opinion. However, the legislature, if it decides to essentially rewrite that or overwrite it with a new law, or in this case a constitutional amendment, and the people approve it, there is precedent for doing that. In other words, the old court case could be, I don't know what the right legal term is, but essentially thrown away, if you will, for something new if it goes through the process. Is that true, or is there a nuance to that?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, yes, that's true. I mean, the Constitution also provides clearly the power of the people, first, you know, legislature, but ratified by the people, to amend the Constitution. So even in that same case, we're talking about the Willikowski case, the Alaska Supreme Court also said that that was a permanent fund amendment, which amended the Alaska Constitution to provide that the money in the permanent fund is set aside, it's the principle is dedicated, and that it required a permanent fund amendment in order to create the permanent fund.
All right. Well, Senator Hughes.
And this is probably for Neil. I've heard some argue that, well, you don't need a spending cap. You don't need to fix the Constitution because if you stick with the for instance, the POMV draw, and even if you were to put that in the Constitution, that takes care of it. But I don't see that. I mean, it could if there were no other revenue, but let's say we develop another big industry in the state, which we actually need to over the coming decades. then you could have more revenue come in beyond that draw, and then you're back in the same boat, kind of what we saw when we had some real peaks in revenue. So do you agree with the statement that a POMV draw, if you stick with it, if that were constitutionalized, for instance, that is enough of a spending cap, or do you think we need this as well?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think these need to be done in concert. This SJR 5, you know, shouldn't be considered alone. You know, we have other constitutional amendments, like constitutionalizing the POMV, that fix different parts of the state's fiscal problem. Just constitutionalizing the POMV would not constrain spending in the future. When you look back at how we got into that run-up of spending, it was because oil revenues were increasing. And it may not be oil revenues next time. It may be some other new industry that comes in. You know, there could be some other run-up in revenues. And without an effective spending cap, we'll just see the same run-up in expenditures that we saw the last time we had a run-up in revenues. So, well, POMV does add stability to a portion of the state's revenues and is the majority of the state's revenues now. You know, it alone doesn't constrain spending. Additional revenues on top of what we currently earn would be available for expenditure under our current spending cap. Adjusting the spending cap really is the only way to effectively constrain spending in a situation where excess revenues came in.
Senator Hughes.
One more thing. I've actually heard people talking about a revenue cap because they think, well, you shouldn't bring in more revenue than you need because it's better if it's in the private sector. But I also think of the Old Testament, and that, you know, there were good times where they stored up food for the times of famine. So I am just wondering what your thoughts, because I have heard people talking about a revenue cap as another way to keep spending down. And I see that as a problem for when you might have hard times and you need to have that in savings. So if you could comment on that.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'd almost go back to my first slide here to kind of talk about that. If we had a revenue cap that didn't allow for us to collect revenue in excess of what we expended, we never would have built $16 billion in savings in fiscal year 13. Which really is what allowed us to weather the last roughly decade of bad years. So, and also the, you know, a revenue cap wouldn't necessarily have controlled the expenditures either. I don't think that is necessarily the effective way to control spending. And as you note, it wouldn't allow us to build up rainy day accounts for revenue volatility like we have relied upon over the last several years.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question actually goes to the slide 3 there, which I think starts right after a pretty significant run-up in revenue and expenditures. But I noticed that as revenues dropped and stayed relatively low, expenditures dropped and stayed relatively low, roughly from FY 82 or 3 to 20 years, FY 0102, something like that. So what was so broken in our Constitution during those times that we were able to do that without this constitutional amendment?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, while there was, you know, you can see in this graph significant spending constraint to stay near revenues, you have, you know, years of deficit spending and a couple of years of, you know, revenue surpluses. But those years, you can also see the dotted line of had SJR 5 existed, you know, kind of effectively following that revenue line, effectively providing a similar constraint that revenue did in those years. But without the spending cap, when you get to those peak revenue years, you see expenditures jump up to match. And that's that exponential growth of expenditures is what we're looking to prevent by adjusting the spending cap here.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So if we track this chart back to, say, from just before the first North Slope lease sales, would we also see a jump up in revenues and a jump up in expenditures to match?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I don't think we've actually done that modeling, but we could produce a graph like that to show you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If my memory of history is correct, I think we would, and yet somehow without a constitutional amendment, we matched revenues and expenditures pretty close after that.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question actually pertains a little bit to Senator Keel's question and then to another section of the bill. So my understanding is the reason that our revenues and our expenditures matched for a good time there back in the 80s and 90s is because, well, effectively, we didn't have any savings accounts to fall back on. So our revenues matched our expenditures because they had to. And so along those lines, I'm curious why we are eliminating the CBR payback, the CBR liability, because it seems to me that that would be another possible constraint on spending, at least in the near term.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, the elimination of the CBR payback, it really is part of restructuring how we access the CBR and what it's used for. With an effective spending cap, we have less concern about expenditures, being excessive expenditures utilizing the CBR for their source of revenue. So there's not quite the same need for the constraint on access to the CBR. We've also eliminated the back pay provisions simply as a matter of kind of reworking the way that the CBR is accessed and the way it works. It really is a policy decision of the legislature as we look at this and as we look at how the state's fiscal picture interacts with the CBR and the reality of the ability to repay the current roughly $13 to $14 billion in debt to the CBR.
All right. With no further questions, Senator Schauer.
Okay. I guess I'll go first. Just a comment, not a question for you. In following this conversation here, I just thought it was an interesting comment in the debate we had a few months ago. And it was about spending limit and whether we would support it. It was kind of a caucus discussion, et cetera. And I thought it pretty fascinating because one of the members said, we don't have a spending problem. We have a cash flow problem. It's basically cash on hand. That's your spending limit. And before I could answer, another member said, well, it's not for $40. We don't need the spending limit for $40 barrel oil. We need it when we get back to 65 or 70. The point is that while I don't, just listen to the conversation, we have shown historically that if we have money, we will spend it, and at times more than that. And so that's where I think this comes to on the historical data that we've proven to ourselves, and that's the problem. We get a lot of money. If we don't limit it and then do smart things with it, we might be in that boat. I just think that's germane to the discussion. Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize if this was covered while I was out in another committee. Slide 5 doesn't discuss it, though, so I thought I'd make sure that it was on the record. And if you've already covered it, just let me know. The reduction that SJR 5 makes in what flows into the CBR in the first place, the application of the word directly so that all manner of tax dollars that currently are required by the Constitution to flow to the CBR no longer would. What is the notion underlying that?
Can you kind of restate the question? I'm sorry.
I think Mr. Milks may have some input on this. Mr. Milks? I see your camera's lit up.
Yes. Bill Milks from the Department of Law. Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Keel. That question, I think you're referring to Section 3 of the resolution. This as an amendment of the provision of the CBR fund, Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund.
Mr. Chairman, the word directly.
No, I'm sorry. You're talking about section
page 2. Line 26, Mr. Chairman.
Would you restate that, Senator Keel?
At page 2, line 26, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Keel. I'm sorry. That's right. The word directly is in there in order to, really as a matter of clarification. We don't see this changing at all, the dollar amounts that go into the constitutional budget reserve, which are money received as a result of termination of, through settlement or otherwise, of administrative proceedings or litigation involving mineral lease bonuses taxes. However, there has been some ambiguity on that issue, I think, as far as one kind of revenue source, which is money that the state receives, even though it is not not the result of litigation or proceeding over what the state is owed, oil taxes or royalties, but instead has an indirect increase in state money results in a context of where there's tariff disputes, which when those tariff disputes are resolved, which are different, they can result in some increased revenue. So that is a clarification that we have in there. Just to be clear, what we're talking about as far as the monies that go in the CPR fund.
Mr. Steininger, do you have anything to add to that? All right.
Mr. Chairman, I have a legal opinion I'd be happy to share with the committee. I think there's a significant issue there, and it causes me great concern.
Is it a personal legal opinion, or do you have a legal opinion from Ledge Legal?
It is from Legislative Legal Services, Mr. Chairman, since I can't afford my own attorney.
It's good to know.
You're a legislator.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd say, yes, I understand that Senator Keel probably has a legal opinion. That this is an issue in which there's been a disagreement across several years with different attorney generals, in which Department of Law has taken one view of what is should be placed in the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, and I think Legislative Legal has a more different view. So.
Thank you, Mr. Milk. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I wanted to mention in regard to the discussion about some suggesting a revenue cap to make it very clear that I'm all about as low of taxes as possible. I was just making the point that there are times where building our savings is not a bad idea, and so I certainly don't want to have high taxes and just to be collecting a bunch of money for the government to hold. That is not my intention in my statement. I just believe that spending restraint is important, and so I believe the spending cap is important, and if we find out then we could lower taxes, I would certainly consider that and possibly be supportive as long as we do have some in savings for hard times. Thank you.
All right, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last one I brought in, and I'm going to show myself underprepared here. The definition of state savings account. I'm underprepared because I didn't go back through the entire Constitution. I'm not remembering it. If we could get what that would be, that would be very helpful.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'll take a bit of a crack at the answer and maybe hand it over to Mr. Milks as well. Generally, when we're looking at that, in the state budget, you'll see fund transfers or fund capitalizations as sections in the state budget where we are either transferring general fund revenues into maybe a designated general fund account, providing for appropriation language that allows for the flow of general fund revenues into a specific account that's then used in future years for a purpose. And then we also have capitalization, things like depositing money into PERS or depositing money into any other number of accounts to be spent on a specific purpose. Some of these get classified as state spending when we move the money into the account. For accounts that can be spent from without further appropriation. Generally, those functions sort of like a capital project, similar in nature to a capital project. You can think of it in the kind of appropriation world, not to get too into depths on that. Others, though, have to be then further appropriated from. So those generally would be what we would consider the state savings accounts. So the payment from that account would count as spending in the year it's spent from the account and then be applied to the spending cap in that year. But that flow of general fund revenues into the account in the first place wouldn't be counted in that year's spending cap. And then there's things like the PERS account, which we see as, you know, that is a transfer of money into the PERS account and would not be subject to the cap when it's going in or coming out. And I think Mr. Milks might be able to give some more nuance if that wasn't sort of enough or if that was a little too roundabout, I guess, maybe. It does get a little bit complicated on account by account basis what counts as spending when it goes in versus comes out.
Mr. Chairman, I think if we're talking about constitutional language, a great deal of follow-up would be worthwhile. It sort of sounds like whatever we say it is when we're strapped for cash.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I would disagree with that notion. It is the definition on an account-by-account basis would be based on how the account is structured and used. So trying to think of some examples here. The alcohol fund. Money flows into the alcohol fund from designated general fund revenues, so from tax revenues, flows into the alcohol fund. But that flow into the alcohol fund wouldn't count as an expenditure for the purpose of the spending cap. However, spending from the alcohol fund would count as an expenditure under the cap. And that's because we don't want to count that deposit into the account and the expenditure from the account twice. So effectively, it's allowing for money to be put into the savings accounts for later uses, so that in years when there's revenue flowing in, it can support a expenditure in later years when maybe that revenue's.
Mr. Milks appears to have something to contribute.
Thank you, Chairman. I guess all I would just contribute on that is that I think, you know, the Constitution, we're using words, like Senator Keel is identifying. So the word here is a state savings account. I understand Director Steiner has explained it in a way where it's a account that exists in the state government where money is put in, but it's not spent. So since it's not leaving the state treasury, then it's really a savings account. So there are examples like Marine Highway Vessel Fund account and various others. So that's the concept for that is that money that's not actually being spent leaving the state should not be counted, even though there's counted as an appropriation for the purpose of the appropriation bill.
Thank you, Mr. Milks. And Senator Hughes is promising a small question.
I'm just wondering how this appears on the ballot, Mr. Milks. It's been a while since we have voted on a constitutional amendment. So does the question appear first and then everything in this resolution, or does it say something like the legislature has proposed and then it gives all the language and the question is at the bottom? This is pretty complicated for a voter to follow. Or is there a simplified version that goes on the ballot with the full thing printed, for instance, in the election pamphlet? Just remind us how that works.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Bill Milks, again, with the Department of Law, and Senator Hughes, and actually I think this might relate back to a question you asked a little while ago about what folks might have understood when the appropriation limit was passed in 1982. I think the best way to look at that is exactly what Senator you identified, which is there's a ballot document, ballot measure. Constitutional amendment will be, there'll be a written ballot measure. It will have the information of the amendment, but the way it's set up is also there'll be a summary of the amendment. The Legislative Affairs Agency prepares the summary. And then there's also, and of course the full text of the amendment is there. And then there is a statement specifically in favor of the amendment and a statement in opposition to the amendment. And so that's sort of the critical information that's before the voters. So it's both the text of the amendment, but also a summary by the Legislative Affairs Agency and a statement in favor and a statement in opposition.
And follow up, that is all on the ballot, or you're talking about in the pamphlet? You're actually on the ballot itself? The
pamphlet. And I'm sorry. But yes, that's all in the pamphlet. I've got an example here of the appropriation limit. 1982 summary, ballot summary. And that's importantly what, you know, when we try to understand what a constitutional amendment means, you know, if there are questions in the future, that's sort of a key piece of information that if there's ever a lawsuit that the Alaska Supreme Court goes to in order to be able to have tangible information on what the voters understood they were approving.
And follow up.
You know, this is the third question.
Well, I know, but he Bill, answer. What exactly is on the ballot? It's just a simple question then, and they have to refer to the pamphlet for all the full text and the arguments for and against. So it's just a simple question on the ballot?
Senator, through the chair, Senator, that's what I understand, but I can confirm. I understand we're going to return to this amendment on Monday, and I can speak with our colleagues in the elections division to understand that clearly, what the thing.
It was a simple question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Steininger. Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Thank you, Mr. Milks. What I believe we're going to do is a little after 2:30 now, we're going to move to public testimony because we've had a couple of really patient people waiting on the line. So I want to open public testimony in SJR 5. Public testimony is now open. And we're going to move to Mike Coons. Mr. Coons, if you would state your name and begin your public testimony. Try to keep it to 2 to 3 minutes, please.
I will. Thank you, Senator Holland. My name is Mike Coons. I am speaking as president of the MATSU chapter of AMAC Action, and I would like to read into the record a letter that was sent by Bob Carlson, president of AMAC Action, to Senator Hughes. On behalf of the over 2.3 million members of the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC, nationally, and our over 8,000 Alaskan members, we are pleased to support your legislation, Senate Joint Resolution Number 5, preparing an amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska to place limits upon the increasing appropriations and spending. Specifically, this amendment effectively reduces the appropriations available rate of increase of 10% to effectively 2.5% by requiring that annual appropriations shall be tied to and not exceed the average of the appropriations made in the previous three fiscal years by more than a cumulative percent change. This approach, in effect, places the governor on the appropriations and spending absent an emergency. I am pleased to offer our organization's full support for Senate Joint Resolution 5, signed Bob Carlson, President, AMAC Action. As president of my chapter, I can tell you that my membership, 350 strong, and talking to Robert Coulter's and his about another 100 and some odd in Anchorage, South Anchorage, they're in full support of this as well. I really appreciate the conversation on this. It was quite an eye-opener. I think the one thing that I would like to kind of add, the question was raised about federal, you know, what we just need to start spending a bunch more money on federal funds. I think, yeah, the Fed's going to give a certain amount of funds, and that's going to be a finite, and then we're just going to have to fight through that at the legislative level or from the budget standpoint. So really interesting, robust conversation on this, and AMAC Action and the chapters of AMAC Action here in Alaska fully support this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. Next up would be Quinn Townsend. Mr. Townsend, would you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Chair Holland and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Quinn Townsend, testifying on behalf of Alaska Policy Forum. Alaska has had a spending problem for years that the state has been attempting to address. While there is not one specific solution to cure all of the state's fiscal woes, one important tool to avoid the temptation of overspending, which will ultimately hinder, not help, the state's economy, is with a functioning constitutional spending cap. Alaska's current cap uses a formula that calculates allowable spending limits to such high levels that it renders them basically meaningless today. In fact, as of 2018, Alaska spent over 20% of its gross domestic product and personal income on state government, which is nearly double the average of the highest economically performing states in the country. In contrast, high-performing states spend about 11% of their GDP and personal income on government. These states, those that spend less and have lower taxes, experience better employment growth, larger net in-migration, higher population growth, higher income growth, and higher GDP. These are all things that Alaska sorely needs to recover from the economic effects of the pandemic. Instead, Alaska's excessive government spending has inhibited private sector job growth, and the economy could benefit from an effective constitutional spending cap now more than ever. Successful constitutional spending caps have several characteristics. First, the base of expenditures covered by the spending cap needs to be broad. In particular, all state expenditures must be covered, not just general revenue fund items. Fee or user charge-based activity needs to be brought under the rubric of the cap. Second, there must be provisions for exceptions, such as disasters and appropriations to savings accounts, to the spending limit, but they must be extremely limited and difficult to manipulate. One approach would be to allow expenditure increases beyond the constitutional mandate only with a vote of the people and or a supermajority legislative vote. Establishing a meaningful spending limit would keep the budgeting process disciplined, control the growth of government, and make the government more efficient. By implementing a meaningful spending cap, Alaska could see much-needed economic growth. Industry and other job creators are drawn to the stability that a true cap on spending would bring. A revised constitutional spending cap is an important step toward responsible budgeting and will encourage a thriving economy. Alaska Policy Forum encourages establishing a sensible constitutional spending cap. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Townsend. Next up would be Bert Huftaling. Mr. Huftaling, would you please state your name, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Bert Huftaling. I represent myself, my child, and the 3,900 followers here in Alaska that listen to what I have to say. I appreciate the time to being able to testify here today. I'd like to concur with both Mike Coons and the Alaska Policy Forum with their input for today. I agree with them 100%. I do find this a very valid measure that needs to occur. There was another bill, which was SJR1, and one of its biggest concerns that I had is being addressed by this here today. If there is a possibility or a way, it would be most advised to join these two bills together as one. That way Alaskans know that we have a stability within our permanent fund corporation and the funds that are there, and it effectively will also help put a spending cap on the limit on what is being able to be spent by putting our permanent fund dividends first to be paid out underneath the statutory formula underneath this POMV draw that you are trying to implement into constitutional law with this SJR5 here. The combination of them both will also help restrain the spending of government, because government will only be able to spend of the POMV draw what is available after the statutory PFD is paid. This would be the one amendment that I wish and hopefully would see here in the future added to SJR5. Thank you so much for your time allowing me to testify here today.
Thank you, Mr. Huftaling. That is the end of we had one person drop off, Joe Bottoms from Wasilla. Sorry, we were unable to get to you before you dropped off. That is the end of online. Is there anyone in the room wishing to provide public testimony? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony on SJR5. And we do have about 20 minutes left of the day, and I'd like to set SJR5 aside at this time, and we'll move on to SJR7. A proposed constitutional amendment related to voter approval of taxes. Mr. Barnhill, Mr. Mike Barnhill, would you like to step up to the table and introduce a bill on behalf of the governor?
Please
Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Barnhill. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and very pleased to present this SJR 7 on behalf of this the Governor's administration. Mr. Chair, I can get through these slides super quick, and I see no problem getting through.
If we get around to it, we do have, I'll just tell people who might be still listening in, let me just check this real quick. We have a few that would like to do public testimony. If we get around to that, maybe we'll do the presentation and entertain a few questions, but try to get public testimony before we end the hour.
Okay, sounds good. So, Mr. Chair, SJR 7 amends Article 9, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution to do two things. The first thing it does is requires voter approval for any new state tax enacted by the legislature. And the second thing it does is it requires legislative approval for any new state tax enacted by voter initiative. And so just a couple details. It adds two sections, Section 1B and Section 1C, to do those things. With respect to voter approval, this is a form of direct democracy. We have that already in the form of a referendum. And so in essence, Section 1B of this provision acts as kind of like a prepackaged referendum. So whenever the legislature enacts a new state tax under this amendment to the Constitution, the voters would get a chance to reject that through a prepackaged referendum. Conversely, if the people should enact a new state tax through initiative, this resolution amends the Constitution in 1C to require legislative approval of that new tax enacted by initiative. In this sense, the constitutional amendment here amends the people's constitutional initiative power so that the legislature has a say in the enactment as well. Functionally, this is a form of checks and balances. So what we've done here is essentially couple direct democracy with representative democracy, and we're requiring both whenever the subject is enactment of a new state tax. That's the concept in its essence. I'll pause and see if there are any questions on the concept.
Very short one, Mr. Chair.
Promises, promises.
It is brought. Has this ever happened where the people have enacted a tax upon themselves via initiative? I'm not aware that it has.
In the state of Alaska or elsewhere?
Just here. Have we ever, have the people ever taxed themselves this way?
Through the chair, I believe the answer is no.
Okay, thank you.
Hold Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was actually going to ask a similar question, but...
I'm sorry. I believe I'm incorrect. I believe the marijuana tax was done by initiative, so I apologize.
That's exactly where I was going. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhill.
No comment.
Good save.
I heard a sigh behind me, so I knew I'd done something.
Senator Keel. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my staff wasn't in the room. That's usually who I hear sigh when I'm wrong. I guess, Mr. Chairman, the question would be, we have a power of referendum now. They've passed, I think, of EPORS. They failed, I think, of SB 21. What's broken about the power of referendum the people have today?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, nothing's broken. The notion here is that we're entering into a new era for the state of Alaska. Likely oil taxes aren't going to pay for everything like they have in the past. We're going to be relying on taxes raised potentially on the people. And so the policy concept here is that we want to have the people's voice more powerfully represented, but also we want the legislature's voice represented whenever we're going to enact a new state tax. So that's generally the idea.
But Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't understand the answer. We've had taxes on the people before. We've had initiatives that enacted taxes. We've had the legislature enact and repeal taxes. So that's all happened. What's broken? What needs fixing?
Again, through the chair, Senator Keel, I don't want to say that anything in the past has been broken, but again, we're entering into a new era where I think there is a likelihood that the people will be taxed in order to support state government, and the policy goal here is to give the people a stronger voice.
Than the one they have that isn't broken. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you. And this is regarding any new tax. So let's just say that, you know, at some point to close the gap, there's a 2% sales tax or something. So if all of a sudden a legislature came in a few years later and said, oh, we're going to raise that to 10%, that doesn't go back to the voters because it's not a new tax. Or do you consider going from 2 to 10% a new tax?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that's a great question because in the provision that we put before the legislature 2 years ago, it covered new state tax and increases to state taxes. We took that language out in this provision. So in the hypothetical you just gave, that increase to state tax would not go back to the people.
That's concerning.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make just two comments briefly, not a question for you, Mike, but one, to Senator Keel's point on that, I think that's, and it's a little bit unfair to you because this is a policy discussion. It's not really something that's your, I think, and I see your reticence to want to answer that. That's a policy question we should ask the governor, because this is coming from his office, and you're often asked to represent it. I'm not scoffing his question. I'm just saying that that's a tough place for you to be, and I get it. That's a policy discussion we should have. To ask staff to do that is hard, number one. Number two, back to the marijuana tax, I see the point. I think, and I know the genesis of this because, again, we discussed this for years before, and this is really about a big, broad-based tax, income tax, sales tax, things that are going to affect everybody. I don't necessarily agree with the marijuana tax answer because it's really more of a user fee for those that wanted it. But I know that what really people are talking about here is, you know, because this is the discussion, right? Income tax, sales tax, a big tax is coming of some sort to pay for this government. And I know that's where this is coming from. So thanks for the comment, Mr. Chair.
If you'd like to proceed, do you have any comments, Mr. Barnhill?
I don't, though.
If you'd like to proceed with, it looks like slide number two.
Slide number two. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, other states have done things similar to this. Colorado led the way in 1992 with enactment or amending their constitution to create what's called the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, or TABOR. And this is a provision that requires voter approval for new taxes and increasing existing taxes at both the state and local level. In Colorado, a number of provisions have fallen under the under this for voter approval. In the committee packet, there should be a spreadsheet. I've given an example of one measure that passed, the marijuana tax in 2013. In your packet, there's a list of 15 taxes that were put before the people in Colorado. 5 were approved and 10 were defeated by the people. Missouri in 1996 amended its constitution to require voter approval of tax increases that amounted to $50 million, and that adjusts for inflation under the constitutional provision. And there's an example here of a Proposition D in 2018, which is a $400 million increase to the gasoline tax that was defeated at the polls. In the committee packet, there's a list of 11 measures that went before the people under this provision in Missouri. 3 were approved and 8 were defeated. And then finally, in the state of Washington in 2001, the Constitution was amended to require voter approval of certain increases to real and personal property tax, sometimes called levy lid lifts. And according to the Washington Department of Revenue, about 75% of these levy lid lifts get approved by the voters.
Slide 3.
The National Council of State Legislatures tracks measures that they call tax expenditure limitations, tax and expenditure limitations by all states. They've got a nice article exploring these. They also have listed pros and cons for legislative policymakers to consider when dealing with measures like SJR 7, SJR 5 to consider. In this particular context, studies have been done, and in this case, the first bullet point refers to a study done on jurisdictions in Eastern Europe, which did seek voter approval of new tax measures, and they found that tax compliance actually increased in those countries where the voters were asked to consent to a new tax. But there are also cons, and the second bullet point reflects that you can have a delay if you're seeking voter approval. for a new tax, and in some cases that delay can be disruptive to the state government if it's run out of revenues. The next two pages, I've simply cut and pasted the bullet points that the National Council of State Legislatures has put on their website. Here's a list of pros that they found in other states that have considered tax and expenditure limitations, and the last page is a list of cons to consider with respect to the enactment of tax and expenditure limitations.
Senator Hughes, if you have a question, I'll let you ask that question. Then I'm going to break for public testimony. We only have a few standing by, but I'd like to catch them in, and then we'll go back and fill up the rest of the hour. Senator Hughes.
Okay, and if they don't have the answer, they can put it on the record and get back with us. I'm just wondering if any of the research shows increased voter participation when such a question is on the ballot. I would imagine it would.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I don't know the answer to that. It does make sense that voters would come to the polls in higher numbers.
All right. So we're going to open it up for public testimony real quick. Public testimony is now open for SJR 7. I don't see too many people in the office in the room I don't recognize. Does anyone in the room want to provide public testimony for SJR 7? Seeing none. Online, once again, Mike Coons. Would you like to please state your name and provide some testimony on SJR 7?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. This is Mike Coons. I am president of the NAPSU chapter of AMAC Action, and I'm speaking. I'm going to do a, for the record, I did send this to Senator Hughes as well as the committee from Bob Carlston on behalf of the over 2.3 million members of the Association of Mature American Citizens. Nationally, and our 8,000 plus American Alaska members, we are pleased to support your legislation, Senate Joint Resolution 7, proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska to prohibit the establishment of state tax without the approval of the voters of the state. Specifically, this amendment provides the citizens of Alaska the right to reject a popular vote a new state tax, and if they approve it, the amendment provides but for a check by the legislature before such a tax can take effect. This is an excellent approach to preventing runaway taxation, and it serves well to protect Alaskans, and certainly seniors, on fixed and modest incomes. I am pleased to offer our organization's full support for Senate Joint Resolution 7, signed Bob Carlson, President of AMAC Action. Again, as the president of our AMAC Action chapter in the Matsu Valley, my people are fully behind this. Reference to the question about what is it, if there's anything that's broken. The answer to that one really, and this is me personally, I'm not talking for AMAC. The problem is dark money. We saw that on ballot measure 2. We saw that actually on ballot measure 1. A lot of money was spent. A lot of that was in the lower 48. We are a republic. We are not a democracy. And that republic reaffirms that we are a Republican form of government, unlike President Biden's comment the other day to the front of Congress, that we the people is the government. No, we the people run the government. We tell the government what to do. The government is us. And so this is a means that we the people then, if the government at Juneau decides that they want to do a state tax or any type of tax, that we the people have the final say on it, and we the people can say, yes, we want to be taxed, or no, we're not going to be taxed. And that would be the final word, and the state Supreme Court would be hard-pressed to turn that one around. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. And before I get to the last person waiting online, I'll just mention that any public listening in can provide written testimony by sending an email to senate.judiciary@akleg.gov, senate.judiciary@akleg.gov. Now we have Mr. Burt Hufftalling. Mr. Hufftalling, if you'd state your name and put yourself on the record and begin any present any testimony.
Hi, my name is Bert Hufftalling. I represent myself, my child, and about 3,900 Alaskans that follow what I have to say. I'm here to testify that I am for actually for putting a tax and putting the vote to the people of Alaska. I would also like to include any increases on any old taxes that may go through legislation also be allowed to be put to the vote of the people. Whether it be new or it be old, it is Alaskans who are going to be greatly affected by the decisions being made there on how much money we are going to be taxed. And in the end, it should ultimately be our decision on whether or not that happens to us, and the vote should always go to both of us. Currently, I'm watching, sitting in the House Ways and Means Committee, them talking about new taxes or spending caps on the budget. And they are looking to push these things through as statutes, and they want to, and we Alaskans will never be allowed to have a say on whether or not we get taxed or not. Ivy Spinonsol's favorite line that came out of yesterday's committee hearings was, is that we are not here to follow statutes. We are here to do as we please. And she made sure to make that very pointed out, especially when it came to our permanent fund dividends, that they don't care what the statutes and laws that we have on the books. Lawmakers make the laws, and they can break them too. By putting this into the statute to where Alaskans have the vote on both new and old, this will prevent statements like that from being able to occur, because they cannot make the decisions without the approval of Alaskans first. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today.
Thank you, Mr. Hufftowling. That is the end of our people waiting online. I'll close public testimony at this time. Public testimony on SGR 7 is now closed. Any final comments from the committee on SGR 7?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
I know that the bill has a couple additional hearings scheduled. I have some significant additional questions about what would constitute a new tax, and as well as some interesting thoughts with regard to local levies that the testifier brought up. So I'll hold those questions for now, but I think we have a lot of looking to do. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Keel. With no other questions at this time, I'll set SGR 7 aside for review and future work. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Monday, May 3rd at 1:30 p.m. We are now adjourned at 2:59.
Good job, Rich.